Shaping the Leaders of Tomorrow by Talking with the Leaders of Today. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Monday, August 30th. This is In the Moment. We begin today's show by discussing the drought conditions in South Dakota when it comes to fire conditions. Darren Klebo is the state of South Dakota state fire meteorologist, and he's with us for perspective. Victoria Wicks has a story for SDPB about comments made by relatives of Joe Beaver, the man who was struck and killed by a vehicle driven by South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg. These comments were made at the recent sentencing hearing. The host of the Lead More podcast, John T. Meyer, is with us. This podcast is designed to help shape the leaders of tomorrow. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in downtown Sioux Falls. I'm Chris Loffrey. Lori Walsh is off today. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. South Dakota Mines in Rapid City is joining the fight to understand and disrupt criminal networks. The institution is partnering with researchers at South Dakota State University, Dakota State University, and the University of South Dakota to create the Center for Understanding and Disrupting the Illicit Economy. Dr. John Keller is a professor at South Dakota Mines. He'll lead a team focused on identifying counterfeit goods. Keller says it's a widespread problem that can have big implications.
Let's say you buy a counterfeit purse. You think, well, I got a good deal and it looks good. And you probably think it's a victimless crime. Well, in fact, those products are being used by terrorists to generate cash to fund their networks.
Keller says it's important to be a conscientious consumer.
The first rule of thumb is if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. You'll notice some of the packaging may not look right. There may be misspellings, or instead of a regular branded box, it comes in a white bag with some cheesecloth.
Researchers will also focus on tracking fake pharmaceuticals and exploring the dark web and other networks used by criminals. State government provided a $4 million grant to create the center. State climatologist Laura Edwards says recent rain is not enough to make a significant impact on the drought.
This week's drought monitor compared to last week shows very little change. And I think part of that is because we are so deep in drought impacts in agriculture and water supply.
Edwards says the state will likely be under severe drought conditions throughout the fall.
If we were to look at historical precipitation numbers and look how dry we are now, we would need maybe 150 to 300% of average rainfall in the next 3 months to really substantially improve our drought.
National Weather Service records show the Sioux Falls area is about 4 inches below normal precipitation this year. The Rapid City area is 6 inches below normal. Residents in a southeastern South Dakota town were cleaning up on Sunday from a storm that toppled trees and power lines and damaged the roof of the high school. The National Weather Service says it will survey the Lenox area to see what caused the damage Saturday night in the small town located 20 miles southwest of Sioux Falls. The Weather Service says there are some indications on radar that it was caused by a tornado. Harold Timmerman is the Lincoln County Emergency Manager. He says there was major tree damage to roofs, vehicles, and other structures in town. A contractor was assessing the damage at the high school, and no injuries have been reported. In today's weather, we have highs in the 80s in the west and northeast, 70s in the southeast, with lows in the 50s in the west and northeast, and 60s in the southeast. Showers and some severe thunderstorms likely in the afternoon in the west. Sunny skies expected in the northeast, and mostly sunny skies in the southeast. Going into tonight, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms with hail in the west. Otherwise, widespread haze and partly cloudy skies. Slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the northeast, and a chance of showers and thunderstorms after 10 p.m. in the southeast. For more news from SDPB, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. For SDPB, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Chris Loffrey in today for Lori Walsh. Have the recent rains across South Dakota lowered the risks for wildfires in the state? Darren Klebo is the state fire meteorologist. He joins us today to give us an idea of where we stand. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it. How is the drought affecting the current situation in South Dakota as it's related to wildfires?
Well, drought and wildfires are very well correlated during the summer months in South Dakota. This is especially true for western South Dakota. And, you know, across the state, we've been really plagued by the drought this year. All of South Dakota has been seeing, you know, abnormally dry all the way up to some D3, you know, extreme drought conditions. And with those dry conditions, it's leading to dry fuels and therefore more wildfires.
I can speak for the eastern part of South Dakota. Over the weekend, we received anywhere from 4 to 7 inches of rain here in Sioux Falls on Saturday. And I'm just curious if the recent precipitation has helped ease the wildfire situation across the state.
You know, it definitely has. There are some short-term gains that we've been seeing in northeastern South Dakota, eastern South Dakota, and Sioux Falls area, like you said. Definitely been wetter than average over the past couple of weeks, several inches of precipitation, kind of widespread. However, if you look towards South Central and kind of the Black Hills area, precipitation has been much more spotty. You know, a couple of random thunderstorms here or there has led to some localized improvements. But the precipitation out west just hasn't been widespread enough. You know, we can take a look at Rapid City over the past few weeks, and it's gotten 2.5 inches of rain. But then you go down to Hot Springs, and they've gotten just over 1/4 inch of rain. So very, very spotty precipitation, and it's definitely left some holes out there that are still susceptible to fire.
I'm just really curious, when the rain comes down like that, Darren Klebo, when it comes down so fast and so furious and the ground is as dry as it is it beneficial or does the water run off for the most part?
It's definitely beneficial, but largely the water does run off the fuels. You know, if we could get an inch of rain spread out over 3 days, you know, in the kind of light mist drizzle fashion, that's definitely much more beneficial. That type of moisture really soaks into the fuels, and it gets deeper into the fuels, and so it'll take a lot longer for those fuels to dry out. When we see these heavy convective thunderstorm-type showers where we get an inch of rain in maybe 20 or 30 minutes, yeah, you are very correct that most of the precip is just going to run off the fuels and not actually go into soaking them and wetting them. And so, you know, and that's why we get lightning-caused fires even in thunderstorms that are producing rain.
That leads me to my next point. All I kept thinking about on Saturday evening was the electricity that was in the air, thinking to myself, this lightning is going to cause a fire or has potential of causing a fire, because it was quite the show here in the eastern part of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with any thunderstorm, we do have the threat for lightning. And even in the thunderstorms that are producing quite a bit of rainfall, what you'll see is lightning strikes that are striking outside of that heavy precipitation core. And so, you know, lightning can strike many miles away from thunderstorms. And those are definitely the strikes that we're most concerned with. You know, if we look at the Black Hills area, over 50% of our wildfire starts are caused by lightning during the summer months. And so it's definitely a player out there. And it's something that we're watching very, very closely in terms of where those strikes are relative to where the precipitation hits.
Here we are just a couple of days away from saying goodbye to August of 2021. Darren Klebo, can you tell us what the month of September looks like?
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag, really, going into September. All the fuels across South Dakota are cured. If we look at the fine fuels or the grasses, the dead grasses, those are the fuels that carry the fire. And so when we see those fuels already cured, you know, it just takes a day or two for them to dry out from any precipitation that we get in order for those fuels to carry fire once again. And so we're coming into September looking at dry conditions. The fuels on the landscape are receptive to ignitions and receptive to carrying fire. And we'll just kind of see how the precipitation plays out a little bit. Right now, it's looking like the western third of the state is going to be near or even drier than average going through the month of September. In central and eastern South Dakota, there are some hints that you might have at least average moisture and possibly even some above average precipitation through the end of September. The other big thing that I want to look at this time of the year is we're not looking at seeing the extreme heat. We can go back to the year 2012 when we had big wildfires kind of across the region coming into the month of September, and we had some extreme heat in 2012, and we're just not seeing that this year. So I have some cautious optimism going into September.
Darren Klebel is the South Dakota State Fire Meteorologist. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
Up next, Victoria Wicks reports for SDPB on comments made by Joe Beaver's family. Mr. Beaver was struck and killed by a vehicle driven by South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg. His sentencing hearing was last week. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Some places, like Tennessee, haven't been bound by a federal eviction ban for some time, but Memphis is working hard to distribute rental assistance and prevent evictions.
We know that instead of just getting one person settled and stable, we could do 100 at a time.
How they're doing it this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menholt Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting is proud to announce the recipients of two National Edward R. Murrow Awards. Lee Strubinger is recognized for excellence in writing.
And they got the news they hoped they wouldn't.
And she was crying. And she's a mom, he has COVID.
And Seth Tupper for investigative reporting.
Somewhat of a head scratcher to think about, well, how did it get there?
The only possible culprit was the fireworks.
Quality reporting about issues that matter are what you get here at SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Turback Law Office in Watertown. Attorneys handling insurance and personal injury claims, willing to work hard for injured people and their families. Learn more about the attorneys at turbacklaw.com.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey, in today for Lori Walsh. When 55-year-old Joe Beaver died near Highmore on September 12th last year, his death made headlines across the country. The attention came not because of who he was, but how he died. He was struck and killed by a car driven by the Attorney General for the state of South Dakota. Now, almost a year later, Attorney General Jason Roundsburg has been sentenced for two Class 2 misdemeanors using a cell phone while driving and driving outside his lane. Just before his two-day trial was to begin, he entered into a plea agreement with the state that dropped another of the minor charges, careless driving, and allowed him to avoid admitting guilt by pleading no contest. Roundsburg did not attend his own sentencing. His lawyer appeared for him. The change of plea and sentencing hearing was held on Thursday, August 26th, at the Stanley County Courthouse, on the same day and time that Roundsburg's trial was set to begin. Joe Beaver's widow and his sister made statements in the courtroom, though Jason Roundsburg wasn't there to hear them. After the hearing, two of Joe's cousins spoke with reporters, including Victoria Wicks, who brings this story to SDPB.
I'm a farmer, and you have to do certain things in certain seasons of the year. You have to plant when you have to plant. You have to harvest when you have to harvest. There's a time for sowing, and there's a time for reaping. And so I've had to go on with my regular life at the same time as I've been fielding questions and issues dealing with the events of September last year.
Nick Nemec has been a spokesman for his cousin since shortly after the collision that took Joe Beaver's life and shook his entire family to its core.
It's been difficult. It hasn't been impossible, but it's been difficult. It's been much, much more difficult, exponentially more difficult for Jenny Beaver, the widow, and for Dorothy Beaver, the mother.
I lost the love of my life, my best friend, and my chance for happiness.
Jenny Beaver reads a statement in the courtroom outlining the characteristics that distinguished her husband, Joe.
He was a husband, a son, a brother, a stepfather, a grandfather. Joseph was a highly intelligent man, teaching me many things in life. And Joseph was a very private and quiet man, but he was a very caring man, which led him into nursing to help people. His patients and many people cared and loved him.
She reads her statement in a flat voice that stands as testament to the depression and sorrow she has suffered since her husband's death.
I've had to start medications to control feelings of rage, anger, and hopelessness, and to help me sleep and stop having nightmares. I dread waking up every morning and going to sleep every night because I know I must face this nightmare every day for the rest of my life.
Jenny says the family has endured intense media attention, and largely because the case has been so high profile, she feels isolated because people don't know how to talk to her about her loss. She doesn't waver when she pinpoints the blame.
We were building our lives together, and now we will never have that again. Since I must live with this every day for the rest of my life, I hope Jason does too.
Jenny then addresses retired Sixth Circuit Judge John Brown directly. Judge Brown made a statement at the beginning of the hearing that he had decided, even before the trial was to start, that he would not sentence Roundsburg to serve jail time.
What he did is he broke his own law. His law states, do not use your phone. And what did he do? He was using his phone and he ended up killing my husband that night. And it has taken an emotional toll beyond anything I've ever seen. So I'm against the fact that he will not get jail time at all.
I understand that, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have waited 349 long days for this case to come to an end, and this is not the end we hoped for or expected.
Jane Beaver is Joe's sister. She addresses the court on behalf of her mother and Joe's six siblings, all survivors, all victims of a quick and shocking loss. She says Jason Roundsburg used his position to delay the case, which has widened and deepened the family's wounds.
We feel that at no point has the defendant shown any remorse and has instead demonstrated callousness with respect to the life he took and the victim's family and friends. He has demonstrated arrogance towards the law he, as an attorney general, is supposed to uphold.
Jane says the family had hoped that Roundsburg would finally have to face them at his trial, but the day before it was to start, he made a deal with the prosecutor that canceled the trial and then didn't show up for his own sentencing.
Why, after having to wait nearly a year, do we not have the chance to face him? We were told that he claimed threats were made against him, but all this time, he's carried on his duties as AG, traveled to a conference in Hawaii, testified in Washington, D.C., and given speeches across the state. Yet he was allowed not to appear today. His cowardly behavior leaves us frustrated and makes moving on even more difficult.
Joe was not just a cousin of mine. He was a good friend.
Victor Nemec is Nick Nemec's brother. He also has spoken for the family over the past year. He recognizes the futility of seeking true justice for an act that cannot be undone.
If there would have been a real trial today, no matter what the outcome, whether, you know, even if it was the best verdict that I could have hoped for, it still doesn't bring my cousin back. He's still gone and will remain to be gone.
Like others in the family, Victor Nemec believes the attorney general knew that he had not struck a deer, as he reported to the county sheriff immediately after the collision.
At times in our lives, we're thrust into a situation where we prove what kind of person we are. And Jason Roundsburg proved what kind of person he was that night when his first actions and thoughts were to try to get his feet out of the fire instead of just admitting to what he had done.
Victor Nemec made his comments in the Stanley County Courthouse immediately after Roundsburg's sentencing in absentia.
And even to this day, he's still proving what kind of person he is by not even bothering to show up today. And the reason he is not showing up today is because it would have been kind of uncomfortable for him. He chose to avoid an uncomfortable situation instead of manning up.
The criminal case against Jason Roundsburg has now been resolved, but Nick Nemec says that doesn't mean the family can just close the gate on this tragedy.
It's a step on the path. I will personally get more closure if Roundsburg is impeached, and barring impeachment, if he's not renominated, or if he's renominated, if he loses an election.
And like his brother Victor, Nick Nemec recognizes that no matter what happens to Roundsburg, his cousin is not coming back.
Joe's dead forever. I'm not sure what closure even means, but if Jason Roundsburg can eventually just fade into obscurity, and in 10 years, people don't even remember his name. That would be good for me.
For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
To access our stories online, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. After the break, we visit with John T. Meyer, the host of the Lead More podcast, which is designed to shape the leaders of tomorrow. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The car of choice for the Taliban, it turns out, is a Toyota.
This is a situation when the brand really has no control over who uses it and how they use it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, sometimes things are just out of your hands. That's next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda in Rapid City. Inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda. See you at Denny Menholt, Rushmore Honda, Rapid City.
I'm Julie Rose. Join me for a special Labor Day episode of Top of Mind. Americans are working more and more hours, and the pandemic virtually obliterated the line between work and home. Are we due for a new labor revolution, this time focused on working less? Plus, we'll hear about the trend of digital nomads taking remote work to extremes. It's Top of Mind.
Listen Labor Day at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain on SDPB.
Healthcare is not only a matter of personal care, but also a major public policy issue. SDPB covers all angles of public health practices and procedures, from illness to recovery. The healthcare beat on SDPB is supported by Monument Health. Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Chris Loughery, in today for Lori Walsh. John T. Meyer is the host of the Lead More podcast. This podcast is designed to help shape our leaders of tomorrow. Now, we know John T. Meyer as the CEO and co-founder of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. He joins us today inside SDPB's Kirby Family Studio. Welcome.
Hey, Chris. Happy to be here.
This podcast, we're going to get into it in a little bit here as far as segments are concerned, episodes are concerned, but take me back to its inception.
Yeah, so last spring, I started thinking about, you know, when I started a business almost 12 years ago, mm-hmm. you go to the state of South Dakota, the Secretary of State, you file your paperwork for $150, you incorporate a business, and all of a sudden you get to be CEO. Mm-hmm. And I always laughed about that because no one gave me approval to be leader. I sort of just mm-hmm. did it, right? Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is that so many other people are ready to lead, capable of leading, and really we need them to lead. But they are waiting for somebody to give them the time, right, to pass the baton, mm-hmm. or it's your turn. And so what I wanted to do is I said, you know, the world needs more leaders, and I want to give other leaders a platform. And so we bring on people to the show, traditional leaders, folks like Governor Dennis Dugard or Stephanie Herseth-Sandlin, Coach mm-hmm. John Stiglmeyer, but also maybe unexpected leaders who are doing amazing things that you maybe haven't heard of. Mm-hmm. And so that was the idea. The world needs more leaders. And leadership doesn't always look the way we may think it does.
Do you think leading is something everybody can do, or does it take a special person to do that?
I think you have to want to do it, mm-hmm. but I believe that everybody can do it. And I think one of the things that the world has changed is you don't have to always lead 100% of the time, right? You can lead a meeting, you can lead a team, you can lead an organization, you can lead a board, you can lead even within the context of a one-on-one conversation, right? There are always opportunities for us to step up and lead. And so there are probably special people who want to lead all the time. Sure. And those are the ones who don't even raise their hand. They just step up and do it. There's that phrase of like, are leaders born or are they made? Mm-hmm. And I definitely believe that they are made. There are certain characteristics of maybe more natural born leaders, but anyone I believe can lead.
What sort of attributes does a good leader have? I mean, if a good leader has what?
Yeah, I think the biggest one that comes up in the show the most is sort of what's between your two ears and being willing to listen and be empathetic. I think we think of leaders as up on the podium, grabbing the microphone in front of a crowd or a locker room. And often it's stopping, listening, being empathetic, understanding the situation that your followers or the people who are entrusting you to lead are in. That seems to come up the most because we think about speaking first when the best leaders listen first.
I once read, it wasn't too long ago, I think it was last week, I read that, I can't remember who it was, they said they lead without even opening their mouths. How's that possible?
That's good. Yeah, yeah, totally.
How's that possible?
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to direct.
Questions, I mean, gosh, even body language, right, can mm-hmm. be part of your leader, like the way you react to stuff. When people look to you as a leader, they're also looking at what you're doing and your behaviors. And so that's why I think that phrase, it's pretty trite, but actions speak louder than words, right? Like mm-hmm. there's a reason why we say that. So yeah, I like that line. That's good.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking to John T. Meyer, the host of the Lead More podcast. You're several episodes into this podcast. How many do you suppose you have under your belt at this point?
Yeah, I think last Thursday, we drop an episode every Thursday. I think we did 65. And so we're over a year. There was two challenges. One, I believed, yes, the world needs more leaders. But two, I wanted to see, I'm not a, what's the best way to put this? Like disciplined person usually. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of like ideas and sometimes chase shiny objects. And so I said, could I do this for 52 straight weeks? Mm-hmm. And we made it. And now we kept going. So yeah, every Thursday we drop a new one, which at times means we're recording a conversation on like a Wednesday afternoon because we're cutting it a little close. But yeah, every Thursday.
And you can find the Lead More podcast on any platform, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, you bet. Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, it's free. Episodes range from 15 to 45 minutes.
Do you remember the first one you recorded like it was yesterday?
Yeah, so it's funny because like a lot of people listen to the first one because mm-hmm. they want to give it a shot. And that was with Governor Dugard. So mm-hmm. we went out with a bang. Technically, was our production was pretty low. I have gotten better, I think, as a host. And so, yeah, we started off. I'm always very much an advocate for start and just iterate and get better. You know, you can spend a year thinking about your podcast. And then another thing I'll say, you might hear someone say, does the world really need another podcast, right? There's so many podcasts.
Sure.
Now we're trying to take kind of more of a niche topic of leadership. But the other cool thing, selfishly, is I've got to have over 50 amazing conversations mm-hmm. with great people. And so when I reach out to a Governor Dugard or a Stephanie Hurst, Seth Sandlin, I could probably get a coffee with them here in South Dakota. But I probably wouldn't get 60, 70 minutes of just one-on-one, intimate, intellectual conversation. And so I like to joke that the podcast is sort of like the new cold email, right? You get to say, hey, you want to be on my podcast? And a lot of people will usually respond to that email.
Let's get into the latest episode. I've listened to it twice. I have to be honest. This is pretty incredible.
This is a short one, so.
It is 10 minutes. It's 10 minutes, but it's 10 powerful minutes, John, because it's talking about something that I don't think I would do.
Sure.
Tell us what you did and for this episode.
Yeah, so a big philosophy of my life is this term I use called Better Every Day. It's mm-hmm. up in neon lights in our office at Lemonly. And the goal is to push myself, push my limits, and try new things, get mm-hmm. uncomfortable. And so I found this event actually about 2 years ago. Sioux Falls Chamber of Commerce, the YPN group, just does this Crossroads conference every other year. And 2 years ago, they had a gentleman by the name of Jesse Itzler come and speak. Jesse's an entrepreneur. He's an endurance athlete. And he founded this event. He's one of the co-founders of an event called 29029. And that number probably doesn't mean anything to most people, but what it is 29,029 feet, which is the amount of elevated feet of Mount Everest.
Right.
And so I know one person, I guess, in my life who has summited Mount Everest. And
the real thing.
The real thing,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, my.
And I met him through this event. So like okay. That's how you, one of the co-founders of the event, he's Guinness record book holder. Mm-hmm. But if you want to do that, it is a event. Summiting Mount Everest is incredibly expensive. It's incredibly dangerous, and it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. Not very feasible for most of us. I don't think I could do it. The risk's too great.
But you found a way to do the equivalent.
Yeah. So essentially what this event challenges you to do is let's go to a ski resort mm-hmm. in Idaho, Utah, or Vermont. I did Utah. And you're going to go up this ski mountain. In the Utah example, it happens to be 12 times. You hike up this mountain, you take the gondola down, mm-hmm. you brand your iron onto your name, this little mountain icon, mm-hmm. and you literally burn it onto the wall, and you get back up and you go again. And wow. So you have 36 hours to do that 12 times which ends up being about 30 miles and 29,000 elevated feet.
That's crazy. That is, it's absolutely crazy. Now you succeeded.
I got it done in 29 hours. So I got a little bit of time to spare. I slept for about 4 hours overnight, took a little bit of break. And I thought I was ready. You know, physically you train and prepare for this. I knew that it was going to be more of a mental challenge, and I wasn't sure yet. I think I'm mentally tough, but you don't know until you actually put yourself in that situation. So
now quickly tell us about the person that got there first, because I was like, really?
Yeah, did you see that? Yeah, some young 19-year-old kid did it in about 14 hours. We started at 6 a.m. I think he finished about 9 p.m. I don't think he stopped for, you know, they had aid stations, foods, and snacks, but I don't think he stopped for lunch or dinner. He just kept going.
But the beauty of it was he didn't just give up at the end. What did he do at the end that just motivated me?
Yeah, yeah. So he finished. He put on his red hat. You get a red cap when you finish. And then he stood there and literally gave everybody a high five. I think the guy stood there the whole time. And so what's cool about the event is not a race. There are no times. We know he finished first because he was first. But everybody else, there's no rank. You either get done or you don't. And so it's pretty cool that everybody is like in your corner and backing you throughout the whole process.
Let's get into the takeaways. First was limits.
Yeah. So in this podcast, I found three real takeaways after doing it. And so that's what I recorded for about 10 minutes is just what I learned. And the first is that most of us, and I really do believe this is true, we set limits on ourselves that are, well, limiting. That we can do more than we believe that we can do. That usually it's our mindset that's holding us back from most of these things. This was a physical challenge, but it really was more, like I said, mental than anything. And so just accomplishing something that you don't think you can do will set you free. And trying to constantly push those limits is what I encourage most people to do.
Your second takeaway was community.
Yeah. So one thing that they do, which is brilliant from sort of an event planning standpoint, is you have to wear this bib. And on this bib, on the front and on the back, are your is your name. It just said John. And so what happens, my biggest hack to this hike was when I started talking to people, I'd walk by and be like, hey, Chris, hey, where are you from? You know, I'm from South Dakota. Oh, cool. Tell me about that. I've never met anyone from South Dakota, right? We've all had that question before. And all of a sudden, you know, I've hiked half a mile, 2 miles, just talking to this person, making small talk, what South Dakotans do best. And so this community forms for about 36 hours. Everybody's in your corner. And what you find is the power of that, cheering someone on. I walk by and say, hey, Lisa, you're looking strong. Great work. Keep it up. It's incredibly powerful. And I think in life, we all have a community bigger than we realize. We sometimes forget to either lean on them or ask for help. And so whether it be the obvious of family and friends or just somebody, like, people want other people to succeed and people want other people to win. And so when you have those folks backing you and you know that. And so I guess my challenge to the audience today is, like, if tell somebody you're in their corner, like reach out, text them, say, good luck on this test. Good luck on this upcoming school year, that new job, and just tell people that you're in their community, because that was incredibly powerful.
Staying with community briefly, do you still keep in touch with the attorney that you ended up befriending and on this, the 65-year-old man that you were walking with?
Yeah, so that gentleman, yeah, I mean, this has been, I finished about 10 days ago, so it's still pretty fresh.
Sure.
But yeah, this guy, Peter, 65-year-old guy, he and his wife finished both before me. Oh. Incredible. Not that I'm some super athlete, but they, I mean, there was a gentleman who was 79 that got 10 out of the 13, summits. And so, yeah, this guy, Peter, he gave me his email address. I was telling him, we hiked the whole hike together for on the second hike. I told him about how I was, you know, in career transition. And he said, here's my email. Like, I want to know what you're up to. Keep in touch. So
that's great.
Pretty cool.
Let's spend some time. Cause this one really, it didn't catch me by surprise. It was just stuck with me. It's be where your feet are. Now, that can be taken a few different ways.
Yeah.
I loved how you put that. Talk about be where your feet are. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I took that takeaway. I shortened it as like in the moment, right? I guess that's appropriate here.
It's appropriate.
So and very appropriate in the line of be where your feet are when you're hiking a mountain. And so what we found, or what I found, when this hike got really hard mentally is when you started looking up the mountain and you saw the top of that peak and it looked far away. You could barely even see it. Or you started playing math in your head and you said, okay, I'm on number 3 at this pace. Okay, I got 10 to go. Should I take a lunch break? What about dinner? Should I sleep or just go through you start running all these scenarios through your head. And all you really need to do is just take the next step. And so one of the speakers at the event said, when you're on that mountain tomorrow, first one, we're taking quitting off the table. He said, just take it off the table. It's not even an option. But two, be where your feet are. And so when I walked away, I found that very analogous to my own life, right? Playing with my two little girls and putting the phone away, or worrying about them going back to school amongst COVID and all the madness in the world. You know, we play these scenarios of fear and doubt and uncertainty in our head that haven't even happened yet, that are even in the future, right? Worried about next year, worried about when you know, 5 years from now. And just to be in the moment is such a powerful sort of unlock that sets you free. And in that hike, that was almost the only thing that got me through it, was just one step at a time.
We worry too much about things that, first of all, are out of our control.
Yes.
Second of all, aren't even here yet.
Yeah.
So be where your feet are means we deal with what we're dealing with right now, not tomorrow.
Yeah, I think we talked about this once on Tech Radio too. There's this philosophy, it's really similar to this philosophy of stoicism, right? And there's some great books out there that I encourage folks to read if they're interested in this. But yeah, being in the moment, and you touched on it, control only, you know, think or only worry about what you can control. Someone cuts you off on the freeway on the way to work tomorrow. Who knows what's going on in their life, right? Who knows? But just you're safe. Be grateful that you're safe. You have a job to go to. Your family is healthy, and be in that moment. Yeah, that was a powerful lesson for me.
In the couple minutes we have left, I took something else from this podcast. It's the Lead More podcast, by the way. Download this and listen to it. It's phenomenal. The tongue is the rudder that steers your life.
Yeah, wasn't that a good line?
I leaned back in my chair and I went, what? That's crazy.
Yeah, I think we forget. This was not my word. Someone used that one that I shared. What we say has a huge impact on what we think and believe. And so we often tell ourselves we're not good enough, we're not pretty enough, we're not smart enough, we couldn't get that job, we couldn't, you know, date that girl, we couldn't, whatever your point of life is. And our tongue, what we say, it's just a little muscle, right, that you wouldn't think matters much, but it really connects to our brain. And that's when, I know this sounds kind of hippy-dippy stuff, but it really matters when you start to really... You can influence your behavior, your thoughts, even your physical body based on what you say. And so, you know, sort of manifesting into existence what you want to see in the world starts with what you say. And so lead with positivity, lead with optimism, tell other people that they're doing great, and that'll come back to serve you.
John T. Myers, the host of the Lead More podcast. You can find this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, things like that. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back.
It's fun to talk about this.
Let's take a moment now for South Dakota history. Here's Lori Walsh.
On this day in 1936, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt attended the dedication ceremony for Thomas Jefferson's image on Mount Rushmore. He arrived in South Dakota on August 28th and made a stop in Aberdeen to take part in meetings concerning the impact of the drought in the Northern Plains. During his travel west to the Black Hills, FDR also stopped in Pierre to inspect a Civilian Conservation Corps project on Farm Island. During his remarks at Mount Rushmore, here is what President Roosevelt had to say. On many occasions, when a new project is presented to you on paper, and then later on you see the accomplishment, you are disappointed. But it is just the opposite of that in which we are looking at now. I had seen the photographs, I had seen the drawings, and I had talked with those who are responsible for this great work. And yet, I had no conception until about 10 minutes ago, not only of its magnitude, but of its permanent beauty and of its permanent importance. This monument is an inspiration for the continuance of the democratic republican form of government, not only in our own beloved country, but we hope throughout the world. Roosevelt continued, "This will be something for the American people that will last through not just generations, but for thousands and thousands of years. And I think we can perhaps meditate a little on those Americans 10,000 years from now. Meditate and wonder what our descendants, and I think they will still be here, will think about us. Let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt, that they will believe that we have honestly striven every day and generation to preserve for our descendants a decent land to live in and a decent form of government to operate under. I am happy to congratulate all of you not only on what we see today, but on what is going to happen in the future at Mount Rushmore. Those remarks were given by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on this day in 1936, dedicating the image of Thomas Jefferson on Mount Rushmore. Production help for This Week in South Dakota History comes from Dr. Brad Tennant, professor of history at Presentation College.
Coming up, SDPB's Lura Rorty reports on providing care for an elder family member or friend. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Scott Tong. Reporter Craig Whitlock of the Washington Post has uncovered a trove of government documents and audio files telling an inside story of the Afghanistan war.
It was remarkable the degree to which they were struggling to figure out who the enemy was. The shorthand for them was the bad guys.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first. Coming up on our next Dakota Life, greetings from Flandreau. Join us as we bring you stories from the Big Bend on the Sioux River. Visit a classroom where young Native students broaden their horizons with drone photography. Then we introduce you to Chase Music, with a band that gives a soundtrack to local rodeos. Finally, we explore geological wonders hidden in the Rimrock as we scour Spearfish Canyon. Dakota Life, Thursday, September 2nd at 8, 7 Mountain. Program funding by Midco, investing in your hometown to bring an expanded fiber network and next-gen tech to your door. Fiber is the future, and at Midco, the future is already underway. Midco.com/fiberforward.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey. Lori Walsh is off today. One in six working South Dakotans provide care for an elder family member or friend. SDPB's Lura Rorty visits with a couple from Sioux Falls who invited their elderly parent to move in with them this winter.
After his dad died, Dave Herp's mom transitioned from the traditional role of farm wife and mother to that of an independent woman and business owner. At 58, Doris was active and healthy. She fully intended to grow old on the family's farm. And for 20 years, things went as planned. Then one day, a phone call changed everything.
My brother called me at, it was noon on a Monday, and he said, I was just on the phone with mom, and there's something wrong. She's trying to explain something to me, and she's mixing up her words, and I don't really understand what she's saying. There's something wrong with her.
A medical evaluation revealed Dave's mom had suffered a stroke. It impacted her mobility and speech.
I point blank asked the doctor, can she live by herself or does she need to have somebody with her? And before the doctor could answer, mom pointed at me and said, I'll go with him. And I thought, okay, so there's an argument I don't need to have with her. And it was really just a matter. I called Chris, and honestly, I thought it would be 2 to 4 weeks.
And just like that, Dave and his wife, Chris, joined the ranks of the estimated 80,000 South Dakotans who provide elder care.
A lot of caring for our elders takes place at home. I mean, there's a stereotype that once a person becomes more frail, once a person needs help, they go to the nursing home. And that stereotype is really a disservice to every family caregiver that is balancing raising children, working, and caring for an elder family member.
Lisi Brown is the gerontology field specialist with South Dakota State University Extension. And she says in South Dakota, it's estimated that some 67 million hours of elder care are provided by family and friends. In Dave and Chris Herp's situation, helping care for his mom was a responsibility they had been planning for, explains Chris.
We'd been kind of planting the seed for a few years that, no, you might just want to come live with us. You know, it'd be okay. It'd be great to have you around. Just kind of dropping hints here and there. you know, just letting her know too that, yeah, the room is yours if you want it.
The Herbs have a spare room, and the couple both have the option to work from home. And although the idea of caring for Dave's mom in their home was not foreign, it has changed things.
Obviously, your lifestyle changes, right? It has to. And you adapt for that. And you know, you make sure that, you know, somebody is almost always here with them. And that means then that it has meant that, you know, we're not maybe able to do all of the things as a family, leave for a weekend or, you know, just do the things, the four of us, or, you know, things like that.
Among the challenges they face as caregivers is making sure Dave's mom lets them know when she needs something.
She's a stoic farmer. Her hand could be cut off and her, and she could be dripping blood all over and she would say, I'm fine. And when she says, I'm fine, that's her way of saying, I don't want to bother you with this. At least that's how I interpret it. So the willingness to sit down and ask sometimes some tough questions and get them to answer you, that I think is a big transition.
His mom, Doris, does not deny this.
Sometimes I'm, yeah, a little bit like that. I don't say everything, but no, it's been wonderful here.
Letting others know how they can help can also be a challenge for caregivers. Lisi Brown says creating a list is one way to communicate how others can lighten the load.
So I'm a big advocate for writing down, okay, so what, in everything that you're doing, and then figuring out, okay, what could I reasonably ask someone else to do? And then making specific asks. Hey, can you go to Walmart? Here's my grocery list. Can you go buy groceries? You know, oftentimes people like to say, oh, just let me know if there's anything I can do to help. And most people never let anyone know what they can do to help.
Brown also recommends communicating with your employer early.
It's really important to like kind of really outline what you're going through and what's being asked of you. And clearly, like, what you're hoping your employer, how they will work with you to make this family caregiving the burden a little bit easier. And we don't like to call it a burden because we all love our loved ones. We all want to take care of our loved ones. But we all know that, you know, it's tiring. It's a lot of work, and it can get exhausting.
Having Grandma live with them has changed the family dynamic. But Dave says when he sees their 12-year-old son help his mom steady herself or their 10-year-old daughter help her put on her jewelry, he knows his mom isn't the only person benefiting from the new arrangement.
It's easy to always think about yourself, but they're starting to see that there are other people in the house.
Because needing help is a natural part of aging, Lisi Brown encourages South Dakotans to begin visiting with their family about how they hope to be cared for so that they can be actively involved in the decision process. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lura Rohde.
If you're a South Dakotan providing elder care or you want to learn more about elder care and resources available to care providers, visit sdpb.org. Josh Rick builds and fixes guitars, and today we talk with him about a guitar built partially out of wood from the Black Hills National Forest. He joins us today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Josh, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is pretty exciting that we get to see this guitar again, because we've seen this before. And we'll get into the guitar a little bit, but I'd like you to just play it so listeners can hear the sound.
All right.
That's Josh Rick on a guitar played on a guitar by wood from Black Hills National Forest. I mean, how long did it take you to build this guitar?
Oh, I don't like to keep track of those things because I'm afraid of what the answer might be. This one was an extra long project because there was so much planning, and I took two trips out to the Black Hills to actually go and source material. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of hours.
So take us back to what made you get into building and fixing guitars. What has it been a while? Has it been a dream of yours? Or what? Take us back to that moment.
So I kind of always had a guitar in the house growing up. Mm-hmm. My mom had a guitar, and it's something, you know, I remember playing with from when I was so small. I'd lay it down on my lap and strum it. You know, it's just always been around. So I've kind of been around instruments and played fairly casually for most of my life on guitar anyway. But I was also really into visual arts in school and took a lot of painting and sculpting classes and that kind of thing. And when I got done with high school, kind of thinking about what I wanted to do, one of the professors up at NSU, Dr. Wieland, asked if I'd ever considered this school in Minnesota, in Red Wing, Minnesota, for instrument making and repair. The thought had never crossed my mind, and it immediately was like, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense, you know, to combine my two interests of mm-hmm. visual and music and bring them together in guitar making.
Talk about what interested you in going to the Black Hills National Forest and building a guitar from products out of the Black Hills National Forest. What take us back to the thought process of building that guitar?
Sure. So when I started, you know, the most of the woods that get used in instrument construction are tropical hardwoods or, you know, spruce from the Rockies or Canada or something. So I came across this amazing curly black walnut that's on the back and sides of this guitar that was from a tree that came down in Sioux Falls. And it kind of sparked this thought of, hey, if I can source this amazing resource right here, what can I actually build a guitar that's made primarily with woods from South Dakota? I mean, resource management and sustainability is always on my mind when we're sourcing woods, especially with the volume of the materials that come from tropical rainforests. So trying to think about how to do this sustainably in the future and to know whether or not there is viable resources around me. So this was kind of a proof of concept for me.
Does it, is the project, because it's built, it's done.
Yes.
Do you just move on to the next one or do you spend time with that one?
Unfortunately, I pretty much move on.
Okay.
Just because the economics of it, you know, sure. I have orders, but this is, I do have an ukulele that started out of the same materials that I'm kind of picking away at here and there. This topwood I've been really, really happy with. I mean, I built this guitar in 2018, so it's aged 3 years now. Mm-hmm. And to the fact that it stayed local is wonderful. So I can kind of come back to it year after year and see how it's holding up, because using pine for topwood isn't normal necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, obviously it can be done. So I want to kind of see how it ages over time and see how it holds up. This is beetle kill pine too, which kind of throws another you know, factor into it. So I'm curious on how it holds up year after year and whether or not it can be a resource that does hold up for 10, 20, 30 years, you know. But I do have more of the material, so I'm looking forward to projects and people that are interested in using alternate sources.
Did you know what you were looking for out of the forest before
Yes.
you even got there?
Yeah, and I took a couple trips out there to go around to some of the sawmills, and I was picking through stacks of logs looking, because it has to be cut the right way,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be big enough. And pine, you know, everybody knows knotty pine, right? It's mm-hmm. it's, which I don't want big knots on my guitar top.
Sure.
But I was specifically looking for beetle kill pine of a fairly slow growing tree of a large size and a quarter sawn piece of wood, which, you know, these are a lot of criteria to put onto things. And I ultimately found the piece back here in Sioux Falls. Somebody had brought in a bunch of beetle kill pine from the Black Hills. And after two failed attempts of going around the Black Hills to lumber yards and sawmills, it kind of came to me, and I found just the perfect piece that was brought in to do. I mean, they were making benches and stuff with them, so I saved it and turned it into guitars.
this month on In the Moment, our spotlight has been on the Black Hills National Forest. So this is just kind of a nice piece to fit in with what we're talking about. Now, you mentioned you have more material. Is it possible another guitar is going to come out of this outside of the ukulele you're making?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, I have some that's going in an electric guitar right now, but I've saved a big piece of the wood that I had cut up for a top wood that will be more tops in the future.
Now, could a person buy that guitar? I mean,
not this guitar.
Not that one.
This one is sold.
That one is sold. But yep. you get a chance to play it, and that's nice.
Yeah, it's nice when stuff stays around and I can come back to it, because usually when I build instruments, they go off, and you know, I don't see the vast majority of them. There's probably three or four that are local that I see regularly, and I've made about 60 instruments, so the rest of them are gone.
We say that because you've got J. Rick Music in Sioux Falls on 41st Street, so you can always call you. And I mean, if you've got interest in that next Black Hills National Forest guitar, it's possible you could take that home.
Absolutely. I'd love to do it.
That's pretty exciting. And you've had 5 hours to get from Sioux Falls to the Black Hills to think about this guitar. So I'm thinking in my head that you were building this before you even got there.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So then, what's the thought process that goes into that?
Well, I was trying to incorporate as much South Dakota material and symbolism as I could. So you know, I was thinking about how to do inlays, and that's another thing we were looking for in the Black Hills was rose quartz I could use, and different materials, like there's petrified wood in here that is from the Mystic area. So just finding whatever materials I could that would relate back to South Dakota, and also to that would be able to be incorporated into a guitar. And a lot of this also is reminiscent of my growing up in the state, and the tie-in with the Black Hills. You know, I've been going out there. My grandparents had a cabin when we were kids, you know, so it's some place that's very special to me. And even just the smell of a pine tree automatically invokes this image of their cabin on the backside of Deer Mountain, going and spending a week out there in the summertime as a kid. So there's a lot of this is personal to me too. Like there's the deer antler inlays, you know, my family's all deer hunters, and just trying to find a way to incorporate that. And there's a lot here that means a lot to me as well.
Josh Rick is a guitar builder, been building guitars since 2009. It's a beautiful guitar. It's built partially out of wood that came out of the Black Hills National Forest. We appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for having me.